Hey guys, we produce this podcast for no other reason than to have a positive impact on the lives of you guys, the listeners, by sharing the stories and lessons of some incredible business owners. If you'd like to support our show, please head to Apple Podcasts or Spotify, rate us 5 stars and leave a review. Your review would be greatly appreciated and keeps us going. And now back to the show. Hello, legends. Today, I catch up with my good friend and founding Cub member, Taryn Williams, founder of Wink Models, The Right Fit, and her latest venture, hashtag Gifted, a technology company that simplifies the way brands facilitate contra gifting with talent. Taryn and I speak about the struggles of the non-technical founder. Innovating your own industry, even if that means that it has an impact on your existing business, and identifying the big problem that you're solving when starting a new business. Taryn is a favorite of mine, and she's even helping me out at the moment with BOA. Hope you enjoy the show. We've known each other for like 9 years now, and while I know a lot about your businesses and your story, we've never actually sat down like this and really
the whole history.
Yeah. So I'm excited to. So welcome.
Thanks
and,
for having me.
And thank you. But you've got your new business now. Hashtag Gifted. Tell me about that.
Yes, I know. I'm crazy going and doing another one after exiting the last one. So essentially it's an app for influencers where it looks exactly like a dating app. They can swipe left and right on gifts that they'd like to receive from brands. And from a brand's perspective, you can post all different kind of contra collaboration. So it's purely unpaid gifting. So anything from like restaurants, hotel stays, like physical products, fashion, anything that you could possibly think of gifting influencers. And we have a Shopify integration as well. So you don't have to have Shopify, but if you have Shopify, it literally manages all of the inventory management for you, creates the order once you match with an influencer and say, yep, you know, I want you to do, you know, an Instagram post or a TikTok video about our product. Once you go, yep, we're all confirmed, it will create the order, decrement it, send it out to the influencer, and they'll go and promote your business however you've agreed.
What a fantastic idea.
Thank you.
It's also a fantastic name, no?
Thank you. Hashtag gifted. I'd had the name for so long, and when I was finally able to use it for this, I was like, oh, yes, because I always wanted to have a hashtag name. So,
but you know what else is really interesting about you? You've always stayed, like you've got your realm that you know and love, and it's like the influencer management style talent, realm. Yeah, talent.
Yeah.
And you've made several or multiple successful businesses within that realm. I just think that's really important to note because you're a master at that. And, you know, being a master at something doesn't mean you only can do one business.
Yeah.
You know, it just means that, well, you can make multiple businesses or multiple services in the realm that you know.
Yeah, I always say I've got really deep domain expertise. It's deep and narrow. And I'm very good at sticking within my lane. Like, people will ask me to come and consult on like a fintech project. I'm like, I'm not your person. Like, I can give you some general business advice, but I know one thing really, really well. And there's so many opportunities within that niche. Obviously, the talent space changed so much since I started Wink. God, how long ago? 18 years ago. And so that's changed so much. You know, it started with very traditional models. It was really before social media. Brands would call or email you to get comp cards. You know, we had physical model books and they would go to castings with their physical book. Obviously, all of that has changed. And then advent of social media, brands started shifting towards using influencers. And so we're like, okay, I need to pivot more into an influencer space. Then online booking platforms like Airtasker. And I was like, maybe I could build an online booking platform. So it was kind of identifying those opportunities and just seeing the market shift and needing to sort of stay abreast of that.
Yeah. And so Wink was 18 years ago, was it?
Yeah, I was 21. I'm 38, so 17 years ago.
Wow. And so what were you always wanting to be in business? Wink was your first business, is that correct?
Yeah.
So were you always wanting to be in business, or what was the catalyst to you saying, you know what, I'm going to be a businesswoman?
I don't think I realised that it was so different. And I think because I'd been surrounded by small business owners and entrepreneurs being in that industry. So everyone, like photographers are all freelance. I was a model first, so photographers are all freelancers. Production companies, creative directors, all of these sort of makeup artists, all of these phenomenal people were sort of self-employed. And so it wasn't like I was surrounded by everyone in 9-to-5 jobs and that me going and doing my own thing was wildly different to all of my peers. So I probably didn't realize that it was such a – so I certainly didn't have some burning ambition to go and be like an entrepreneur or business owner. I just sort of identified this problem, thought I could do it better, build my own agency, and went and did it without really thinking through. And also I was so young, right? Like I had no idea how challenging it would be or managing cash flow or any of those things. So the blissful naivety of youth really helped as well. I think if I'd known it was going to be so challenging, you never would have done it. But I certainly wasn't like, I want to go and be a business owner. I'm going to start my own company. It was more so like, I see this problem. I want to go and fix it. And I didn't have, thankfully didn't have to go and quit a 9-to-5 job and make that, because I can understand for people that would be super challenging to go, gosh, I've got this safe and secure job where I get paid this, you know, nice salary and I have my 4 weeks annual leave a year and sick leave to go, God, I'm going to go and be self-employed. So
you were modelling and you had a model agency.
Yeah.
And you thought, wow, I can do this better than they're doing it. Was that the major problem you were solving?
Yeah, I just had so many sort of negative interactions in the modelling world. And it wasn't specifically my agency. It was just kind of how the industry was. So models generally didn't get paid until 90 days after the job. So the client would pay the production company, and the production company would then pay the modelling agency, and the modelling agency would then pay the model. And the sort of unwritten rule was that you didn't get paid until all of those people had been paid. And I was like, that kind of seems crazy to me. Like, that's not how any other business works. Like, it doesn't matter if, you know, for a courier company, they pay their couriers every week or fortnight. Doesn't matter if David Jones hasn't paid the courier company. Like, it's just not how any other industry works. And so I was like, that seems really crazy. And there was this kind of really like, not rule by fear, but models were really quite terrified of their agents, and it wasn't a collaborative, collegiate sort of relationship. You were sort of really like, I've got to do exactly what they say. And you were terrified of calling and asking for your pay and being like, I really need to pay rent. And so I saw all of these really amazing models drop out of the industry because they couldn't juggle both having, you know, either studying or having another career on the go and modelling, because they were so sort of terrified of having this conversation with their agent. And they financially couldn't afford to stay in the industry because they were like, I can't pay my rent. I know I just got this $10,000 job, but I'm not going to get paid for another 3 months. Like, this just doesn't work. So I thought, okay, why don't I start an agency that just pays everyone in 7 days? Like, that can be our thing. We'll just pay, we'll do weekly payroll like any other business. We'll be like a little family. We'll treat them with decency and respect, because they're also going through like a really interesting period of their life. You know, this sort of, let's say 18 to 25 years where they're moving out of home, having their first big breakup, probably at uni or doing something, so that they don't have, whereas in a normal job, you would have all of your colleagues around you for support through all of those things. So I was like, well, let's try and be that for them as well. And so that, and I really wanted to have a really diverse talent pool as well, because it was sort of still back in the days where it was very traditional looks of models and what was beautiful. So I was like, look, I think there's a demand for this. We were seeing advertisers starting to shift into ethnic diversity, age diversity, size diversity. So I was like, well, we could be at the forefront of that. So yeah, that was where the idea came from.
I love the idea. I love the concept of like the other agencies, they were the boss and the model were the kind of employee. But you, and even the way you marketed it was like, well, you know what we're going to do? We're going to actually build an agency for the model.
Yeah.
Attract the best, really the model, the talent is the the product in a sense. Yeah. Like, so if we attract all the best talent, well, we're going to be the best person for the brands to partner, or whoever you partner with as an agency to partner with. And the fact that you're like marketing, like being known for, I'm assuming it wasn't your marketing slogan, but well, it might have been, but paid in 7 days. You know, if I'm a model that's used to getting paid in 90 and someone says paid in 7, well, I'm choosing them. You know, like, that's such brilliant marketing.
And it was totally unintentional, and you're absolutely right. It became this beautiful self-fulfilling prophecy where clients would come to us because they knew we could call in last-minute favours with people, we could guarantee them the best talent because we had built such a great relationship with these people. So, you know, a client could be like, oh my gosh, we've got this last-minute thing, can you help? And I'd be like, hey, I've got 7 models all available, willing to drop whatever they had on tomorrow to make this happen. So yeah, it helped us attract the best talent. Clients knew that we were, because clients could still pay us in 90 days. We didn't have to make them pay in 7. We just bankrolled everything. So it really allowed us to have this amazing relationship with our clients where they felt super supported by us. They could see that we were trying to do the right thing and change the industry and make it safer and make it better and support our talent. And talent finally, I guess, felt seen and heard and a part of something, like that their opinion mattered, that they were valued. And yeah, so it was a sort of whole dynamic shift.
You solved their biggest problem, which was I'm just not getting paid fast. Or I'm not getting paid probably a lot of times. Yeah. That's the biggest problem. Yeah. But then you said, okay, well, who are these people? Like, they're young women. They're at this age. There's a lot going on for them. They haven't got the typical work community around them to help them through their career. We need to then create a community for them. So it's like you solved problem number one, big one, bang, made that the marketing and made that the core message. And then you went and solved the smaller problems as well. So you didn't just stop there. And I think that's a really great way to think about a business. It's like, okay, if I'm going to create a business that solves a problem for whoever I'm solving that problem for, what's the biggest problem? This is the biggest problem. Okay, what are the smaller ones, these ones? Okay, let's just try solve all of them and make the biggest one our slogan.
Yeah.
You know, like
so
it's
true.
Easy way to do
and
it.
And often it's not that complicated. Like obviously I had come from the industry, so I sort of knew what the problems were and that I'd faced and, you know, feeling isolated or not having a support network. But once you sit down, a lot of those things didn't cost us any additional money, right? Like obviously we had to learn how to manage cash flow and bankroll these payments and stuff. But doing the other things, you know, being kind to our models, organizing get-togethers regularly, being on the end of the phone to help them through tough times, like those things didn't cost us money. It was just a positioning and values shift. So a lot of the time it doesn't have to be this over-engineered, you know, really scary thing. You can just go, as you said, like what's the biggest problem people face? Can I solve that? Yes. And then what other value add can I add to my customers or potential customers that's really going to put us apart from the competition? So, yeah, I love that way of thinking about it.
And what did the first 3 years of Wink look like?
Oh, my God, it was painful. I was working 24/7. Like, I just reinvested every single cent back into the business. I didn't draw a salary and really just tried to grow the business. We didn't have – I think for the first year I didn't have any employees and then – or close to a year and then started building out a team. And it was – I always say the difference between that and my next business was it was like a true small business. Like as soon as you could afford to like get an office space, then you got an office space. As soon as you could afford stuff, then you hired staff, you know. And so it was very much an organic growth. There was, you know, it was completely self-funded. I remember the days of like, you know, going on Google and Googling like photographers in Sydney and like going through the first 10 pages of Google, writing down their details, cold calling, you know, all of like the true hustle stuff. So it was pretty brutal, I'm not going to lie. Like I was working literally 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, but I was really passionate about it. And I think because I had the support of both sides, like our client base and our talent base, and I could see what a difference it was making, it made it all worthwhile. But yeah, it was certainly challenging.
Yeah, I just always think it's important for people to hear that it wasn't easy and like the start was rough and like it wasn't glamorous or anything like that.
Absolutely not.
It's just not, but sometimes you like, sometimes like a big issue for I reckon young entrepreneurs these days is that they go on their socials and they see really like glamorous things from other entrepreneurs, men or women, and it looks really easy, really good. And they're like, yeah, okay, I'm gonna just do that. But you know, sometimes it might be nice to show, or it's good when people hear like what you said. Like
I couldn't agree more. And Bonnie Giles, a friend of mine, has a beauty business and she posted something yesterday on Instagram just saying, I just want to share something that's happened to me and $19,000 of my orders have gone missing with Australia Post and they're somehow here and I don't know where and all that money comes out of my pocket and I know all you see is this beautiful like, oh my God, all my products selling out. And she's like, it's not that easy. And I was like, God, I really need to do more of that because so often there's just, I mean, one, there's the day-to-day grind of like, me just sitting in my office for 10 hours a day, sending emails and taking calls and, you know, doing product management, which no one gets to
see. Yeah, which isn't glamorous.
Not glamorous,
you could argue it's boring, but it needs to be done.
Exactly. So no one gets to see all of that stuff and they don't get to see the times where it's really bad, where it's like, you know, 11 o'clock on a Saturday night and, you know, a server's down and you've got to jump on that and you've got your overseas team trying to jump in and help. Like no one gets to see those things. So I definitely think we need to share more of those.
And how has – so you got through those first 3 years at Wink. Would you say that – or what was the most important thing you did that was or trait that you had that enabled you to survive those first 3 years? And I use the word survive because I really think that is the appropriate word for a business's first three years.
Yes, if you get through that, it's literally day by day fighting. Look, I think I did have some really amazing mentors around me. I probably didn't realize it at the time, but I reflect back now and I had two or three people around me who were much further along their business journey than me, who were really helpful in just being able to problem solve things with me where I'd go, oh my God, I didn't know we needed public liability insurance. What is that? And they'd be like, okay, here's a broker, go do these things. Have you also got these insurances? These are the other things you should think, oh, okay, great, thanks. So I think probably having really good people around me and also probably because I was so young, I didn't have a fear of putting my hand up and saying, like, I don't know how to do this. I haven't done this before. Could someone help me? I definitely stayed away from that whole, like, fake it till you make it. Like, I wasn't like, I'm amazing and I've got everything under control. I was like, hey, like, I really need help building out. I ended up building a tech system for Wink that was like a complete onboarding, calendar management, payroll integration, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I don't know how to do this. I really need help. Could someone like walk me through this? And so I think, yeah, being able to ask for help, putting your hand up and knowing that you don't know things, having like mentors, whether they're formal or informal around you. Yeah, otherwise I would not have been able to get through that first 3 years.
And how has Wink or how has that industry changed in that time? Because yeah. I imagine it would have done a complete backflip.
Oh my gosh, it's changed so much. So firstly, probably the ideals of beauty have changed, which I think is something we lobbied for a long time, like shifting away from that. You know, they must be tall, they must be Caucasian, they must be blonde to be, you know, beautiful. So that's fantastic. We're definitely seeing brands really embrace ethnic diversity, age diversity, size diversity, which is awesome. And in a much less like tokenistic way, like it's not that like United Colors of Benetton ad where it's like everyone's maybe different ethnicities, but they're beautiful in 20, you know. It's like actual real diversity now, which is great. So definitely that. The speed in which jobs turnaround is obviously so much faster now than it was before. You know, it used to be clients would come up with a campaign, they would have a casting, they would, you know, have a couple of weeks of pre-production, they would shoot the campaign, and then the campaign would run for like maybe 12 months. Like it would be a TV ad, right? And it would run. Now, obviously, because of all of the social channels and the amount of content that we're inundated with every single day, brands have to shoot, like, instead of doing maybe two big campaigns a year, they're shooting like 15 times a year, which is great for us in one sense that they need more and more content, they're shooting more and more models, but the usage periods are shorter and models get paid on usage. So they get an hourly rate and then they get paid for basically like the likeness of their image, the blocking them out of working with a competitor for a period of time. So they now shoot more and more frequently, but the pay is lower and it's faster turnaround. So we have to be much more agile in how we get models to clients and how we turn things around.
And when you were watching all of this unfold, were there things that you thought, wow, that's a great opportunity? Or how did you identify the things that were going to be good opportunities for you while within a changing market?
Yeah, so probably the biggest one was building the tech platform for Wink. So we had about 650 models Australia-wide at the time and I was like, this is not sustainable. We are texting clients like, yep, she'll be there in 15 minutes. Models are texting us at the end. I did an hour and a half overtime or they're emailing. We're getting on the phones. We're calling 25 models. Are you available tomorrow for a shoot? And I was like, this, we've got to use tech to solve this. This is one, it was all held in everyone's heads. So if a model or a booker left the agency, we lost all of that information. Like what models does that particular client like? And all of it was done manually. So they'd be writing down a list of here's the models that are available tomorrow, emailing them to the client, getting the ones back, calling the girls back, yep, you've got the job. Not scalable, not sustainable, and so much opportunity for human error. And I was like, okay, I've got to fix this. So probably the biggest change was recognizing that, going out and building a tech product on the back of that to streamline the business because all of the other modeling agencies were just using that manual system. So it was probably a product that nearly killed me at the time because, again, non-technical founder, I was like, right, I want to build an app because, you know, this is 12 years ago. Apps are cool. I'm going to build an app. It's not an app. But I went out and I met with all of these different tech companies and I was like, this is what it needs to do. It needs to be able to check availability, needs to be able to schedule them on shifts, and it needs to be able to manage their payroll at the end. So like they log their hours and then we pay them the right amount of hours and we invoice the client the right amount of hours. So I thought super simple, right? Like, I don't know, do we 3 month build, problem solved? Absolutely not. And it was totally my own fault because, so I ended up going with a company that built fly in, fly out software for miners. And I was like, well, technically it's kind of the same thing. Like they needed to check shifts like, does this person have like a bulldozer license or whatever? We were like, does this person have blonde hair? Like, yes, tick, send the shift to them. If they are available, send that option to the client and then schedule their shifts and pay them correctly. So I was like, kind of the same thing. But I had no idea about like building an MVP, like a minimum viable product. I was just like, oh my God, I can build anything I want. And they were having an absolute field day. They were like, absolutely. Or you want a button to like, I built so many things like you can search our models if they have a manual driver's license because like one client ever once asked that. So I was like, need to build that. I just went mental and I was like building out all these features and functionalities, and now I want it to do this and it manages super and blah, blah, blah. So it turned into like an 18-month build, cost $500,000, nearly killed me. Because once you're, as you know, once you're in, you're stuck. Well, you're stuck. Yeah. You can't just be like, oh, wow, we really need to stop this. I had to get it live. But it completely transformed that business, and it meant that everything was super scalable. We could manage all of those models on a much lower headcount of internal staff. We didn't lose all of that retained data over time, and we could pull really interesting insights. Like, you know, this client normally spends 4 times a year, but this year they've only spent 1.7 times. Like, okay, what's going on here? We need to get back in touch with that client. So that was probably the biggest unlock in that business.
And was that a catalyst? Because that was the first time you dipped your toes into technology. Was that a catalyst for the next business, The Right Fit then?
Which, from what
I understand, was an entirely technology business?
Yes. So I got to the end of that build and I was like, oh my God, why didn't I just build this platform for clients to be able to completely bypass us? They could just list their job in this app and send it out. Like, ugh, it was kind of as Airtasker was launching in Australia, and I was seeing this opportunity to move to like a marketplace. I was thinking, wow, what I should have done was just build this direct, and I should have added all the other things that they needed. So photographers and makeup artists and stylists and any sort of other production person. So I actually went and saw a bunch of my clients and I was like, okay, I've built this fancy system for Wink. How much value does an agency provide in the transaction? Pretending I'm not an agent, like just put that a bit aside for a minute. If you had a tool like this that you could use directly, would you use it? Or are you like, no, we really need an agency to manage all of these pieces for us? And they're like, no, we would absolutely use that. Like they were still having a lot of pain points with agents where they're like, you know, we call and we don't get a call back for 3 days. And I was like, okay, there's a proof point here. I should try and build this out. But that time I learned at least build an MVP, brought my engineering team in-house from day one, had a product manager and went, okay, what do we need to build just to test this before we go down the, you know, building an absolute, you know, huge system? And so, yeah, that was where the idea for The Right Fit came from, which was essentially this two-sided marketplace. Clients could post a job for anything they needed, photographer, model, influencer, actor, blah, blah, blah. And we would then match them with talent. But literally the MVP was clients filled in what they thought was like, I'm posting a job. It was just a form that came through to us. And then we would go, who do we have in the database? Like we had about 400 talent that we'd pre-registered in beta. And then we would go through and be like, yep, we've got a talent for that. We would send them, email them, hey, there's a job booking for you. Magically appear in the back end for the client. Ta-da, like there's a talent available. And we did that for probably, I don't know, maybe 3 months to make sure we had a proof of concept before we actually went and built a marketplace.
Well, I think that's really important. Lesson that you learned, like you built a tech platform that was still manual just to test that it was worth spending all that money on, you know what I mean? And I think sometimes people think like, okay, no, I have to be a technology company. It has to be automated from the start. That's not, you know, ideally it is.
Yes.
Like ideally, yeah, in the perfect world, the quicker you're automated, the better. But before you sink a bunch of cash in, you know, making it look automated when it's actually not might be the way.
I always say do things that don't scale. For the first like 3 to 6 months, do things that don't scale because it also helps you understand where the pain points and the blockers are. Like you might go, okay, well, you know, we're going to build this matching system and it's going to automatically match people and send them the jobs and they're going to reply. And then you find out, well, actually talent don't respond to emails. Actually, we need an SMS system. Or we need, I don't know, we need an app and push alert. So if you don't do the bits that don't scale, you kind of don't know that yet. And also you just don't know if it's even a good idea. You know, you have all of the right signals from the market saying, yeah, I think, you know, we would use this or whatever, but you know, you don't want to sink, $500,000 into a build until you're really confident.
And then
confident.
Realize,
built
it wrong.
Not a good idea. Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And you said something really interesting, which was, that I was almost making my other business redundant, or like I was trying to make my other business redundant. A lot of people would say to you that, are you dumb? You
know, yes, like, totally. Totally. I had so many, especially when we started talking to investors, they were like, you're going to cannibalize this other business that you own that's really profitable and has a great reputation. So, talk me through why you would do that. And I was like, well, if I don't do it, someone else is going to. Like that is abundantly clear. Like
that would be my thought process too. And it's actually very forward thinking in the sense that It actually, like the way it would really play out in real life wouldn't cannibalize the existing business, because if a major shift in the way an industry happens, if a major shift in an industry, like a major change happens, it happens over time normally and slowly. It's not just the existing yeah. business don't just die.
Yeah.
But if you're the person that makes that shift, you know, you're going to, long term, you're in the wind, plus your existing business is still going to keep doing really well. It's only if the new business gets so good and so big that it just absorbs so much of the market that yeah. that your existing business can't do.
Yeah.
That's going to play out. But really, you should be trying to make yourself redundant, or you should yes, be trying yeah. to make your existing business redundant, because if you want to be the best in your industry, well, you need to be better than yourself.
Yes, totally. And I think it's so easy to sort of rest on your laurels and get comfortable and be like, well, you know, we've been doing this for 12 years or whatever it was at the time. Like, this works. We've got comfort. You know, I'm only having to work, whatever, you know, part-time. Good, good, good. Everything's working. And get really complacent. And I think if you do that, you're so, especially in this market, like, you're so at risk of being disrupted by someone else. Like, you just can't rest on your laurels and have that complacency. And I think exactly what you said is so right. Like, we did see a portion of Winx clients go to the Right Fit, but we also saw, you know, another portion of new clients come in who were like, no, we really need a full service agency. And so what it meant was I had both of those clients. So the clients that maybe couldn't afford to use Winx because of agency service fees or the models rates, obviously models rates were cheaper when you're hiring them direct through the Right Fit. So I kind of managed to capture all of the market. So instead of just having the portion that we had before, it expanded our customer base. So yeah, it was.
And you're a non-technical founder, which yeah. as we kind of rolled into this episode talking about, so am I with Boa.
Yeah.
And it is very hard, you know. What are the most challenging things you think that come from being a non-technical founder?
Oh my gosh. So I had a early mentor who I had gone to see when I was kicking this idea around, should I build the Right Fit, blah, blah, blah. I went and I said, oh, I know I need to build a payment gateway. I know I need to build like some way to charge people online on the internet with credit cards. Could you, this guy was like CIO of like one of Australia's leading companies. You can just imagine, I'm like mortified when I think back on this conversation now. And I was like, so could you just, and he was like, okay, yep. Cause I was like, I know I should use, there's Stripe, there's Braintree or PayPal. Which one of those should I use? And he was like, do you know the difference between like a front end developer and a back end developer? And I was like, no. And he was like, okay. And do you have a product person? No, it's not a product. It's an online business. And he's like, no, that's not what a, okay. So you don't have a product manager. You don't know anything about tech. Okay. All right. Look, I can help you with this piece on, but I think you've got some bigger problems. And he was amazing. And he sat down and he spent a lot of time. He ended up joining my board and was like, look, he had been a non-technical founder. He had scaled a bunch of businesses. He was American, sold a bunch and ended up moving to Australia. And he's like, look, you need to learn these things if you're going to be a non-technical founder, but you also need to pair yourself with someone who's really strong technically. And, you know, there's some really quick ways to get yourself up to speed on some of these things. Like you do need to know the difference between a front-end and a back-end developer. You don't need to be able to read code, but you need to be able to understand how a product roadmap comes together and how to prioritize things and how to deal with bugs. And so I went and did a whole, like any course that I could get my hands on, whether it was online, I did a bunch of General Assembly and I just really tried to upskill myself as quickly as possible, because I realized I thought being a non-technical founder was okay in that, oh, that's fine, I'll just get those engineers to do that piece, that's fine. I didn't realize it's actually about how you shape the entire business. And so I had this idea that we would build the Right Fit, it would be finished, you would just build it and it will be done and that's great, I won't ever need an engineering team again, or maybe I'll need one person who just, you know, helps with product and field improvement.
Tightens the screws every
exactly,
now.
Exactly, exactly. Not right. You know, I thought it was like building a house, right? Like, you know, you build it, it's done and then, yeah, you might
get a handyman back every
exactly. now. Exactly. No. Like you just hire more and more engineers, you have more and more product roadmap ideas, you've got more features to build. So it was a really big learning lesson for me. I think if I hadn't had that mentor and I hadn't had people around me to go to and go, wow, I'm way out of my depth here, it would have been an absolute nightmare. And it still took me so long. You know, I look at the first 2-3 years of the Right Fit and I go, oh, I made such bad decisions because I just didn't have the technical expertise. And I probably didn't, No, I don't want to say have enough trust, but I think I thought, okay, I can brute force my way through these things. And, you know, similar to what I was saying.
The Daniel method.
Similar to what I was saying to you before, like just do it faster.
How hard can it be?
just build it. It's only a form. Why can it take that long?
My 2-year-old could do this.
Exactly. With actually having no idea, like, no, it's like a really complicated thing.
I don't even have a 2-year-old. But that's how you feel.
Yes. And it's so frustrating because you're so used to being a doer and just being like, I'll get on the tools, I'll do it. And you're like, I physically cannot get on the tools. I do not know how to do this. So
it's a relinquishment of power and control as well.
Yeah.
And it's in a way where you can't say, as the founder or the owner or the whatever you are, you can't be like, I'll just move, I'll do it.
Yes.
You know, and that is a good backup because, you know, for any other role, if someone's just like, if someone screws up or leaves or whatever, either you can just move, I'll do it, or there's someone else on the team that can do it.
Yeah.
But when you're a non-technical founder, it's just, you can't even use another team member to do it because you don't understand how to do it. So you don't even know if they understand how to do it.
Yeah, you know, it's totally. And you don't even know how to hire for their replacement.
Yes. Yes.
So it makes it really challenging.
It is. It makes you feel a little bit insecure in a sense. Like.
And I have so many people ask me now, like, well, what would you recommend then? Should I use an agency? Should I, you know, how do I try and hire a CTO or a senior engineer to bring in-house? And I'm like, I wish I had a good answer for you because all of it's complicated. Like I've seen so many people work with agencies, nothing against agencies, but end up being way overcharged or ending up with a product that doesn't really work. And then they're like, great, I've just spent $150,000 and I've got this app and I need to start again.
And you can't switch is the problem.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Because then you take it to the next agency and they'll be like, oh, they built it so wrong. We can't even touch it. We're going to have to start again.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's the same concept. It's like, if you get one designer to design your house and you get the next designer come in, she goes, oh, it's horrible.
It doesn't matter.
It could be the best house ever. She's still going to say it's horrible.
Like, so true.
As a non-technical founder, you're in a real tough spot. Well, one thing I did, maybe two things I did. One is that I used someone, because Boa still, and Cub, because Cub has its own full social media and its own full back end. We used a member named Gail, who I've known for many, many years and done a lot of work together. At the very least, I trust Gail and he's a friend. And trust in a business relationship, I trust Gail is going to do the best he can and what he thinks is best.
And the best thing for the business.
Yes. Yeah. And trust is probably the hardest thing because when you don't know what someone's doing,
I found that
trust was good. And the other thing, though, that we've done is that I'll get Gail and his team I'll get other technology people to look at the code.
Yeah.
You know, and they've got nothing to do with it. They might be an investor or a board member, or they might be like one guy just ended up advising me every now and then. I wanted him to be the CTO. Then I realized, what am I doing? I can't spend money on a CTO right now and I can't afford it for Boa anyway. And then, you know, like it's just not the best use of our money.
Yeah.
So this guy who's amazing was just every now and then looking at our code and looking what we built with the assumption in the future he may be a CTO. Joining. So like but having multiple people look at what someone's doing, at least that person knows, because even if you trust them, everyone gets complacent if no one's checking. Doesn't matter who it is. Yeah. You, as a CEO, get complacent if no one's checking.
So true. You know, you don't have a board to report into. Yeah. You're like,
It's either your board that's checking or it's your wallet.
Yes.
If your wallet starts going down or that starts checking you, you're like, okay, I better start working on it. But everyone needs that. So I think having someone you trust, if that's possible, it was for me because of Cub and having an amazing network, but having someone you trust and having multiple eyes look at the thing, and then embedding yourself in the team that's building it as much as possible. They would be the things, and they would be the things I learned.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah, I think you can't have this arm's length relationship and just go build me this thing and deliver it finished. Like that's just not how it works. And even if you write the best spec documents, you write, you know, the clearest, you know, UX experience that you want people to have, you still need to be really hands-on and going through the process and going, hey, this doesn't work the way I wanted it to, or could you help me understand why we built it this way and why it's going in that direction? You have to be like, I think if you can bring team members in-house full-time, doesn't mean, like, I've got part of our team are offshore and they're phenomenal. Like I've got no issue with people using offshore developers or resources. it's all just about having them as like a real part of your team and not, I think, not contractors. And I couldn't agree with you more on what you said about having people around you that you trust. I have two technical advisors now, and it's exactly what I do. I'll go to them and say, hey, look, we're speccing out this new thing. I think I want to use these types of technology. Could you walk me through like some of the pain points with this? And then can you oversee briefing this into our engineering team and just being around, you know, over the next 6 months to check in, go through, audit some of this, make sure it's being done in the way that's, you know, setting the business up for success long term.
It's, I forgot what I was going to say about technology. It's also, sorry, you were saying that like things change, you know, like I designed like this and it didn't. That is the biggest plight of like the startup. Like yeah. Even for us, like me and Laura, well, Laura does all our design for the platform. We'll design something and we'll think that's the right thing, but then you implement it and you want to change it because people start using it differently yeah. How you expected. And so there's this never ending changing going on. And it's not like when you change something at Cub, which has very little effect on cost. It's very quick to do. And if it doesn't work, you can change very quickly. When yeah. You're changing in technology companies, there's big yeah. Time loss. There's big expense
yep.
And there's also just mental health.
Yes, totally. I mean, a great example at the moment is I want to change our onboarding form at HashGifted is instead of first name, last name, it's just full name. And you put Taryn Williams all in one cell. And that means every time that we want to email someone just with their first name, we have to run a query to split their first and last name to only embed first name. Instead of if we had built the fields, first name, last name would have solved us so much problem. So I was like, okay, can we just change that, guys? Can we just change it to first name, last name? Any non-technical person is going, yeah, it's super simple, right? Like you literally just changed two fields. No. What happens to all the historical data? How are we going to pipe them into the correct – how are we going to fix the database? Now we're going to have – we can't have two concurrent databases running. You know, we need to have – so they're like, sure, Taryn, it's a really quick change. Like in your mind, it's like – actually, you know, a really intense piece of work for us. So and, you know, how much
and,
do you want
it? And then you touch it here and then it breaks over here. Yeah. And it's like, yeah. What did they even have
all
to
of a
do
sudden
with
your,
each other?
Your emails have no name in them because yeah. It's like it's pulling from the wrong place in the database. Or you're like, oh, God.
It's like if I got angry and kicked the pylon here at Cub Potts Point and then somehow a window in Melbourne broke.
Yes. Like, yes.
It just would never happen. But yeah. In technology, yeah. Like, that's happening.
Totally.
And we actually both did something similar. Because you have all these changes going on, technology becomes incredibly expensive. Mm-hmm. Whether you have an outsource or internal, I agree, internal. I'm a big advocate for everyone being internal and not outsourcing, and we will be doing that as soon as we can. And obviously Gail knows that. But it's hugely expensive.
Yeah.
And the problem – so what I think most people should do or something to consider – is create a business first that isn't a technology business.
Yep.
Get your cash flow, get your money, because it gives you a lot more freedom it gives you much more ability to survive, to last. Your existing business can help you pay for the technology business. You can still raise capital, but you're going to have an easier time raising capital because the investors can see, wow, I'm investing in someone that has already built
a sustainable business.
Yeah. And like if I didn't have Cub, Boa would be very daunting.
Yeah.
And my own wealth because it's just this big money sucking thing that, you know, you don't anticipate creating money from very, very soon.
So I mean, I look back at Tierra. So we raised money really early with the Right Fit. We're probably 3 or 4 months old. Purely because we'd been approached about raising capital. There was a venture firm that were interested in investing in us and I was like, I don't know, it seems like what you do and that's really flattering and it's really exciting. I want to raise capital. Great. I can stop funding it through Wink and it means we can scale really quickly. We can hire more people and do all these things. Fantastic. Let's do it. What I didn't realize was the impact on my mental health and the speed at which we had to grow. All of a sudden you go from, okay, well, like, you know, we're self-funding this and we're spending whatever, 40 grand a month. I can't remember what it was at the time, but you know, we're growing organically. And as we can afford more things, we will add more things. And, you know, of course the business is still losing money at that point. You've got like very few customers, high overheads of team costs and whatever. All of a sudden you raise capital and then you're like, shit, we raised saying we're going to have, you know, 1 million customers in 12 months time. holy shit, we've actually really got to go deliver that. And so all of a sudden you're running before, I always say it's running before you've learned to walk. You're like, shit, we were crawling. We were just getting out, you know, the basics of that down. Now we're expected to be like champion marathon runners and we like haven't figured out the basics yet. So I remember having so many nights where I'd be like, oh my God, we're burning like $150,000 a month and I've got like 9 months of runway left before I have to go and raise more capital. And you feel like you can't share that with your team because like they don't want to know that we're about to run out of money in 9 months.
But so they're not getting paid.
Exactly. So you're like, okay, I've got to keep them excited, incentivized. I've got to keep, you know, moving this business forward and doing everything I can to move it forward. But shit, you know, I'm also terrified that what if I can't make this thing work? And yeah, it was a real adjustment for me. And I couldn't agree with you more in that I've been able to self-fund Hash Gifted through my other businesses and wealth. And it just takes a lot of that pressure off. It means that you can make more strategic decisions. And we will absolutely raise for Hash Gifted, you know, without a doubt. But we'll do it at a point where we've really got the metrics right. We understand exactly what the drivers of the business are. We've already got product market fit. And then we're raising because we know exactly how we want to scale it instead of raising to build it.
I agree. It's a lot, and you feel more comfortable when you raise capital knowing that this works. We're raising capital to fund it working faster.
Yes.
You know, like to grow it faster.
Yeah.
When you're raising, and I mean, there's nothing wrong with raising before you have that, but it is definitely more stressful because you're almost taking people's money to figure out how to make money with it.
Yeah.
As opposed to taking money, knowing how you're going to make money with that money. It's a very different concept. Did that stress and the stress of entrepreneurship ever impact your life in
Oh my God, absolutely. Like took a massive toll on like my interpersonal relationships. Like it's definitely the killer of one of my romantic relationships. Friendships that had to be, you know, thankfully I have a lot of friends who are entrepreneurs, but other friends who just had to be so accommodating, where you've probably been through this as well. So many times you have to be like, shit, sorry, not going to make it to dinner tonight, stuck with this chaos at the office. Or even when you're there, you're not mentally there. You know, you're really like ruminating on, fuck, I've got these 8,000 other things that I need to be doing right now. It's an all-consuming journey, and I don't recommend it if you really can't be in a position to go all in for a period of time. And I think it's mentally consuming, it's emotionally consuming, and it becomes so much about, I mean, unless you're much healthier at being able to have some separation than I was, it becomes so much about your identity and who you are as well. You're like, I am putting everything on the line to build this business. You know, my self-worth, is all attached to this business. And so, you know, it took me a long time to kind of get that separation and step back and go, okay, like it's okay. Like, the business, I think in some ways it's a healthy driver. Like it really, like I have to make this work. You know, it's mine and it's my thing. But also being able to step back and go, okay, I'm a separate entity to, you know, my commercial successes.
I think that happens over time when the business matures. It's still there always, like, but when you start a business, the business needs you to do everything.
Yeah.
So you are the business, actually. Yeah. You know, it's not a business, it's you doing things.
Yes, yeah, pushing it forward every single day, yeah.
And then, you know, slowly you'll get more team members and you're still essential. If you're not there, everything falls over. And then eventually you get to the point where you feel like the business has grown and is independent enough of you that even if you left, it can, it, you know, it, obviously you always need to be there as the, every business needs a leader, whether it's you or someone else, whatever, but it always needs a leader, but it can function without you. And then once you realize, okay, wow, I've grown this thing to a level of maturity where it's not dependent on me, it's a lot easier for you to realize like, okay, maybe I'm not that. And so then what am I? And, you know, I can actually see you going through that with your journey because, you know, you got to the, like Wink got to it this with this really big point and you were like, oh, you know, this is working without me. Maybe now I can build the right fit, build a technology platform in the same industry. And the you know, and so you must have felt, I assume, I'm guessing here, but correct me wrong, you must have felt like I can focus on this and Wink is still going to run and do well. And therefore, like maybe I'm not just Wink, maybe I am an entrepreneur in the talent space and I can do other things or maybe I can, what's, like I like to think, what's the most important thing that I can be doing right now, me personally?
Yeah.
And maybe for you at that point, you know, you had gotten Wink to this huge point that was going really well. Maybe the most important thing for you to do was not to manage Wink, but was to look for the next huge growth opportunity.
Yeah. It's so much about getting out of your own way. Like, I think that for me, when I remember, because we'd raised capital, I was running both Wink and the Right Fit. And when we raised capital, obviously I had to go full time the Right Fit. Like, and I literally had no hand over here. Thankfully I had a good GM in Wink already. But I was like, hi, gotta go, bye, good luck, Godspeed. And I remember going, let's see how this works out. Like, wow, I've been such a pivotal part of this company for whatever it was, 10 years. You know, I get 600 emails a day. Wow, like this is gonna be chaos. Within it, like a week, no emails on my Wink address. No one misses you, right? Like you've got this. And it was a massive ego blow. I was like, wow, I was not that important. Here I was thinking it was all about me and, you know, it was fine. Like the business had years of systems and processes. It had, you know, the tech platform. It had good leadership. It didn't need me. And it took me that to go, okay, it is safe to make this, you know, the control freak in me could go, it's safe to make this step. It's safe to make this decision. And exactly as you said, it's what was the best use of my time? Because that team or that business couldn't go and do this next thing that I wanted to do. It had to be, you know, the risk taker and innovator and entrepreneur in me had to go and do that thing. And I had to itch that, scratch that itch as well. Like I had to know if I could do it or not. I was like, you know, rather die knowing that I've given it a shot and if it's worked or not. And so it is much easier now on the, whatever this one is, fourth one, to be able to go, okay, this is the best use of my time and I'm going to apply my time over the course of the week in these particular ways that add the most value as opposed to things that don't.
It also makes room for people to move up in your organization because if you're no longer going to be the managing head of that company, someone else has to, which means someone else has to take their role and someone else has. So it creates progress for your team and the more you're able to grow and enter new markets and do things as a company, the more progress your team sees and the less likely they're going anywhere or moving anywhere because they're like, wow, I'm actually achieving something here.
And I think there's such a big difference between an entrepreneur or founder and a CEO. Like I am not a CEO. I do not enjoy CEOing. Like that is not the best use of my time and skill set, right? Like it's a very different skill to being a founder and entrepreneur. I love this piece, like the founder and entrepreneur 0 to 2 years. I love that. That's my sweet spot. After that, like, I'm not interested, you know. Yeah,
I don't enjoy managing it.
No, I don't want to do that. And there's people out there, you know, and I've had various boards at different points in my career who have been like, no, like you're a good CEO and, you know, you could grow and develop some of these other skills. And I'm like, but why would I? Like the opportunity cost for the business and for me is not worth it. I mean, maybe that's just me being stubborn, but we can hire a great CEO who does all of these things. Like why would we get someone who's like a bit of a mediocre CEO, make them do it and make them do things that they don't enjoy and are not, you know, awesome at? Like, seems crazy to me.
Yeah, but I mean, it also takes a lot of self-awareness to do that.
Yeah.
You know, because you're understanding, well, you know, I could do it, but I don't feel naturally the best at it and it's not what I like to do anyway.
Yeah.
And therefore, we'd get a lot more bang for buck from me if I focus on this rather than that.
Yeah.
You know, so it just takes a lot of self-awareness because a lot of people, like what you were saying before, the company is me. A lot of people are like, no, I can't relinquish that.
Control, yeah.
Whereas in my perspective, it's always been like, I would love to relinquish that, you know, and not so much because I don't enjoy doing it, just more so that means like, wow, I've really built something that like if I die,
we'll
like
continue on.
Yeah, which I like. It's kind of like was Julius Caesar and all these giant emperors get addicted to it, like it's legacy.
Yes, yeah.
You know, like you this company continues and even longer than you live potentially. Yes. Like that's a really cool feeling.
And I think about like you selfishly, my day to day, I want to be surrounded by fucking amazing people. Like I don't want to just be like this, you know, dictator at the top who's like everything my way. I'm like, wow, look at this phenomenal, I don't know, digital marketing person or this growth expert or this CTO, like, or this CEO or COO, like, wow, I get to, you know, be surrounded by people who are teaching me something every day. Like what a better experience.
Yeah, yeah. I read a tweet, an X, or whatever you call it now. I read a post on Twitter, on X, fuck.
I'm still calling it Twitter.
Yeah, I do too, to be honest. I think Elon's pretty cool with that anyway. I don't think he's got a problem with it. Like everyone does it. But so I read a tweet the other day. I don't know even who this person is, but it said, let me just bring it up. I screenshotted it. Yeah. Okay. Her name's Cody Sanchez. Don't know who that is. But she made a tweet that said, your goal as CEO is to build a team that runs your entire company better than you.
So good.
Yeah.
So
I feel like that's what we're talking about. And so I, when true. I read that, I was like, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
Like, that is your job, like, yeah, as the owner, is to build a company that has a team that runs the company better than you do.
Yeah. Yeah. Like experts in each particular field that are, you know, running harder, doing a better job, looking to you for leadership, as you said. Like, I think leadership is always
leadership's different.
Yeah.
Yeah. Leadership's different,
yeah,
than actually
execution.
Yeah. It's, yeah, very different.
Couldn't agree more.
We do have to wrap up now, but I thought I'd ask, what's, you were saying, you know, the mental stress that entrepreneurship has put on you at times, how difficult a lot of the starts of the journeys were, but I know that the difficulty continues anyway. So there's a lot of negatives in business. Why, what made you want to do that? What made you want to stick through and continue doing it? Like, why did you do it if there was a lot of bad impacts on your mental health, on your life? Why did you keep going?
Yeah, I mean, everyone asked why I went again after selling The Right Fit, because I was supposed to have a 12-month sabbatical, which I failed at. I'm attracted to exciting ideas. I have these ideas. I want to bring them to life, and I get so much fulfillment out of seeing them birthed into the world. Like, I'm not a parent. I imagine it's kind of like, you know, seeing your baby for the first time, and I'm like, wow, look at this thing. Like, this idea I had is out in the world, and it's operating without me, and it's doing its thing, and people are using it, and I'm so proud of it. And, you know, I get so much joy and fulfillment from that. And I really do love seeing, identifying changes in an industry or opportunities and going, there's something there. There's something that I could, if I go deep on that, I love putting people and resources around a problem and making something come to life. And it's like quite a terrible addiction, I'm sure. Like, it can't be healthy, but it's like, so I just derive so much satisfaction out of it, and I love it.
And what are the positives that have come from your life because of that?
I've learned so much. I am so grateful. Like, through all of these challenging, shit, awful, horrendous times, I've learned so much that has served me not just in my commercial life but in my personal life. Like, the personal growth, I always say it's kind of like an expensive MBA every day. Like, you're spending a lot of money and you're going through a lot of, like, personal challenges, but you are growing and learning and developing. And, you know, I'm just fundamentally such a different person now than I was, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And I think that that's something that you get through being a founder and entrepreneur that you just don't get any other way.
Yeah, yeah. It's like a personal, you feel stronger.
Yeah.
You feel more capable.
Resilient.
And, yeah, resilient. And that's an addictive feeling.
Yeah.
Like, you feel better.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And even the way you react to things, I don't know about you, but, like, I look back on how I would have reacted to something 5 years ago versus now, and I'm, you know, you go from, oh my God, this is like the most stressful thing ever. Like, oh, how are we ever going to solve this? To going like, hey, I know I can solve this. I've been in worse. Like, it's going to be okay. And you're like, wow, okay. Like, and you can take other people on that journey with you and help them sort of go through those moments of adversity and realize they can do it.
And give them the shortcut to,
yeah,
you know, that's not how you do it. That's how you do it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's amazing now. I'm sure you have the same thing. You know, you meet someone, you do a mentoring session or whatever, and these tiny little, you know, things that I guess come second nature to you now. And for people, they're like, oh my God, that was like such a wake up moment for me. Thank you for sharing, you know, those two or three gems of information. And you're like, gosh, I didn't realize that that could help expedite someone else's journey so much. And that's an addictive feeling too, where you're like, wow, I added such, you know, a huge amount of value to someone.
I feel
someone.
Smart.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like I'm adding value here.
That is good. That is a good feeling. No, it's so weird to think back. Like, when you think back of yourself, as the CEO or as the owner, you know, 5 years or 9 years or 10 years ago or whatever it is. Like, when I think back to how I was at the start of Cub, I'm like, I can't even believe Cub made it through. Like, you're just not good yet.
Yes.
You know, it's not a question of, you know, you're just not good yet. You haven't learned how to be good at business or how to be good at leadership or how to be good at hiring, or like, you're not good at stuff. And and if you do it long enough, you do get good enough. you do get better. Like,
Yeah. It's so true. You reflect back and you go, oh my God, I made some horrendous decisions, or why did I approach that way? But it was the only, we were doing the best we could with what we had at the time is what I always reflect and go, that was the skill set I had at the time. There's no point beating yourself up about it, and just reflect on, how far you've come from there. And I think sometimes the only way to learn is through the painful process of doing it badly and getting better.
That's the best way to put it. And do you want to say anything about hashtag gifted, who should be checking it out, who should believe when they find it?
Yes, I would love that. So if you have any kind of business that does contra gifting to influencers or wants to do contra gifting, so if you want to make user-generated content, if you want to get social proof for your brand, if you need more ratings and reviews, literally it's sector agnostic, so it works for any business, then please, come along and check it out. Happy to give anyone a free month as well. It's month-by-month membership, so there's no lock-in contracts or anything like that, but happy to give any of your listeners a free month as well. So just shoot me an email. I'm very easy to find online.
We'll look you up. If you want to get in contact with Tara, you can go to cub.club/podcast and you can find details there along with greatest lessons of business, favorite books, and other information from our other incredible guests. If you want to catch up with Cub on social, it's at Club United Business. It's equally as awesome. Taryn, thank you so much
for
coming in today. It's always nice to see you. Although we've been seeing each other a lot lately because we're working together a lot more.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the show.
Thanks.